This Taisho is to be played on October 17th, 2010. I'm recording it 3 days before because I won't be here on that date. I'll be in Cleveland leading a meditation intensive, we're calling it. But I wanted to talk about the six realms of existence, six realms of unenlightened existence, because that will feature prominently in the Great Jukai ceremony that's coming up in next month. Every 3 years, our Thanksgiving weekend Jukai ceremony is a Great Jukai, which just means more elaborate. And the main, more elaborate thing is a portrayal of the six realms of unenlightened existence in our walkway behind the Zen Center, where we set up kind of a visual audio presentation of these six realms. Also, we're trying a new thing this year where we're having a kind of a Six Realms film fest. And for each week in the weeks leading up to Great Jukai, except for the week that of the November Sesshin, for each week we're presenting a film here at the center that seems to represent one of these realms of existence. This week, this past week, it was the Hell Realm with Ingmar Bergman's Cries and Whispers, and then I'll just keep going after that. First of all, what are these six realms? Well, they're six planes of existence in the world of desire. In Buddhism, in traditional Buddhism, we talk about the three worlds, and that usually that means the world of desire, the world of form without desire, and the world of formlessness. And according to one text, these six realms are all in this lowest of the three worlds, the world of sensuous desire. And there are some Buddhist texts that describe hundreds of realms within each of these six realms of unenlightened existence. Another way to look at it is these just describe six forms of samsara, six different ways of experiencing the wheel of life or the wheel of suffering. And they can either be taken literally, which would have been most common in among the uneducated, or not just uneducated, but in traditional Buddhism of the past. These could be taken quite literally, these six realms. But in contemporary Buddhism, they are very, even more commonly looked at as metaphors of experience, human experience. Bodhidharma himself looked at these six realms. He divided them into the three lowest. The three lowest he called the three heavy planes of existence. What lands us in one of these three heavy planes of existence is, he says this in a text from the Dunhuang Caves that appears in the book Zen Dawn, translated by Cleary. Bodhidharma says that we land in one of these three heavy planes of existence by indulging the mind of the three poisons. The three poisons being greed, anger, and delusion. And he articulates this further. He says if deeds of anger are serious, this delivers us to a hellish state. If deeds of greed are serious, this delivers us to the realm of hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits. And if deeds of delusion, the third poison, if deeds of delusion are serious, this delivers us to the realm of animals. These are the three lowest realms of the unenlightened existence. And then the three less grievous planes, we get a break here. These are, we consign ourselves to, by cultivating goodness, but with the mind of delusion. Remember, these all six of these are states of unenlightenment. And here that means that we still haven't seen through the fundamental delusion of self and other, us and them. But even though we haven't, we still manage to cultivate goodness, and to use Bodhidharma's words. So if we seek blessings but cling to belief systems, then this consigns us to the fourth realm up from the bottom, the realm of fighting demons or titans. The traditional word is asuras. If we create love and hate, to use his words, but we uphold the fivefold discipline, then this makes us humans in the human realm. And in the highest of these six realms, if we're still seeking happiness, but we do so while cultivating the 10 virtues, and we'll go into these 10 virtues and the fivefold discipline, then we manage to rise up to the realm of the gods, or the devas, to use the traditional word. One of the better treatments, I think, of that I could find of the six realms is in a book called Thoughts Without a Thinker by Mark Epstein, who is a psychiatrist, I believe, MD anyway, but he sounds like a psychiatrist. And here he talks about how we can understand these six realms in a figurative sense. He says each realm becomes not so much a specific place, but rather a metaphor for a different psychological state, with the entire wheel of samsara becoming a representation of neurotic suffering. He says further that if aspects of ourselves remain unintegrated, that is, if there are parts of us that remain undigested, cut off, denied, projected, rejected, indulged, or otherwise unassimilated, if that happens, they become the points around which the core forces of greed, hatred, and delusion attach themselves. They are black holes that absorb fear and create the defensive posture of the isolated self, unable to make satisfying contact with others or with the world. He went on to say, the paradox is that which we take to be so real, ourselves, is constructed out of a reaction against just what we do not wish to acknowledge. We tense up around that which we are denying, and we experience ourselves through our tensions. So, always in Zen and in Buddhism generally, we have to find ways to own every aspect of our minds and our characters, to shine the light of awareness into these parts of ourselves that perhaps we've been cut off from for so long. In Zen, that is done principally through meditation. In other Buddhist schools, there are other ways of doing it, but in Zen, it's through Zazen and through the extension of this mind of stabilized awareness, extending that into our life of activity. In this way, we come to awareness. Awareness is basically what Buddhist meditation all comes down to, every kind of Buddhist meditation, awareness of what is going on in our minds. So just to review a little bit about these six realms, now from a different source, this is Lama Govinda, one of the great scholars of Buddhism from the last century. He says this realm of sensuous desire, this world of desire, is divided into six main planes according to their respective degrees of bondage and suffering. And this is in his book, The Psychological Attitude of Early Buddhist Philosophy. And again, in ascending order, there is the plane of suffering par excellence, or hell. There is the plane of unfulfilled desire, or hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits. There is the plane of animals. There is the plane of, in his words, prevailing antagonism. These are the titans, the fighting demons. And then there's the human plane. And then the highest, being the higher beings within the sense world, or the devas, the gods, we might say. By the way, the order of these six is, there's a lot of, variation in how they are, articulated. Some have, the fighting demons realm as the second highest after the devas, but actually I find it most useful as Roshi Kaplow did, of keeping the humans as the second highest for reasons that may become clearer as we go on today in our talk. So really, these six realms could also be understood as the six aspects of karma, of conditioned existence, that we not only evolve in, you know, rising from the lower to the higher realms through our spiritual practice or our deeds, but also that we can sink in. This is what is so sobering about these. So, for example, we're living in a time of that has historically been one of great prosperity and privilege, at least in this country. And we see many people who could be considered living as gods. But then until enlightenment, we are always vulnerable to sinking into lower states, which again, to keep up with the metaphor idea, means sinking into lower states of consciousness. So first, this realm of hell, starting from the bottom. In his book, Thoughts Without a Thinker, Mark Epstein mentions the traditional Buddhist description of this as literal hells. Where those living in hell are depicted as suffering an assortment of infernal tortures. They can be seen boiling in hot oil, being dismembered by wild animals, freezing, starving, and suffering a variety of other hideous punishments. In other words, it's a realm of excruciating suffering, the worst kind of suffering. Even if we don't accept the idea of a hell realm in a literal sense, a geographical, physical place where beings are undergoing these kinds of agonizing forms of suffering, we don't have to. We can easily see them in a contemporary sense that in worlds that we can find on our own globe, and that would be these worst cases of suffering, mass suffering that we all know about. The rape of Nanjing in China, right before World War II began. Of course, the Nazi concentration camps during World War II, the Stalinist labor camps, and then, much more recently, the terrible, horrific cruelties and suffering in the Congo, in Sierra Leone, Rwanda, in the Sudan, Darfur, and in Bosnia, in the Bosnian War, and even perhaps in different places in the Middle East. I sometimes think of Abu Ghraib, what our own soldiers did in the prison of Abu Ghraib in Iraq some years ago. I don't have to continue citing these different examples. When we come across reports in the media of reports that make us just cringe and recoil with horror at the barbarities that humans can do to one another. How is this not hell? But aside from these physical hells, the older ones, the traditional Buddhist hells, and the more recent ones in the world, then we can open things up a lot by looking at hell as again as a metaphorical, as a non-literal sense. And here Mark Epstein in his book gets into some of this. I'm going to read from this and from another book because they're so well put. We have to, you know, fairly race through this material just to keep it within 45 minutes, so I'm going to take a shortcut and do some reading here. He says that the hell realms are vivid descriptions of aggressive and anxiety states. Beings are seen burning with rage or tortured by anxiety. I think of panic attacks. From what I've heard, genuine full-blown panic attacks are nothing if not hellish. Think also of excruciating marital conflicts. This is why we chose Bergman's movie Cries and Whispers as a representation of hell. It would be easy enough to find movies that show terrible physical cruelties. These are all too common now, but rather than have those images, sinking into people's minds, we thought a hellish marriage or hellish emotional states in that movie would be a little more palatable. Trungpa, the late Tibetan teacher Chogyam Trungpa, in his book Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, offers up his own ways of understanding hell. He says it's an environment of claustrophobia and aggression, excruciating and continuous pain. In each of these realms, these six realms, in the traditional depiction of them in the Wheel of Life, there is a, right at the center of each of these realms, there is a bodhisattva holding something that represents the alleviation of the particular suffering of that realm. And for hell, the bodhisattva of compassion is often shown holding a mirror or a purifying flame that indicates that this particular suffering can only be alleviated by seeing the unwanted emotions in the mirror. This is a psychological way of understanding it. We have to see in order to get out of our hell, our psychological hell, we have to look directly into our suffering. Epstein goes on to say, when we refuse to acknowledge the presence of unwanted feelings, we are as bound to them as when we give ourselves over to them indignantly and self-righteously. He goes on to say, religion has traditionally counseled believers to withdraw from aggressive, erotic, or egotistical states of mind and replace them with the purer states of devotion, humility, or piety. Then he says, psychoanalysis has encouraged its adherents to be less fearful of these emotions, to understand their roots and recover the energy that has been lost through the failure to accept primitive urges or longings. But Buddhism takes the middle path, which is recognizing the need to be free from such destructive emotions, but at the same time seeing that the way to this freedom from them comes through awareness, non-judgmental awareness of those very destructive emotions. And of course, in Zen, that non-judgmental awareness comes through Zazen. So when we're sitting with in hellish states in Zazen, let's say we slip into one of these in Sesshin, that's when they're most likely to arise. What we have to do is not flee them, not fight them, but look directly into them via the practice we're working on, the breath or the koan. which means not getting caught in thoughts about them, about these hellish states. This is how we can transcend them without either wallowing in them or rejecting them. So that's enough on hell. Let's get out of hell here. The next realm up, the second lowest, is the realm of hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits, which the Sanskrit word is pretas, P-R-E-T-A, pretas. First, the traditional literal description of hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits. These are shown in Buddhist, ancient Buddhist art as phantom-like creatures with withered limbs, grossly bloated bellies, and long, thin necks. And reading here from the Epstein book, in many ways, these represent a fusion of rage and desire. He says, tormented by unfulfilled cravings and insatiably demanding of impossible satisfactions, hungry ghosts are searching for gratification for old, unfulfilled needs whose time has passed. They are beings who have uncovered a terrible emptiness within themselves, who cannot see the impossibility of correcting something that has already happened. Their ghost-like state represents their attachment to the past. I found this very interesting. No other description of this realm have I seen it related so much to the past. But it really makes sense. He goes on to say, in addition, these beings, while impossibly hungry and thirsty, cannot drink or eat without causing themselves terrible pain or indigestion. The very attempts to satisfy themselves cause more pain. Their long, thin throats are so narrow and raw that swallowing produces unbearable burning and irritation. Their bloated bellies are in turn unable to digest nourishment. Attempts at gratification only yield a more intense hunger and craving. These are beings who cannot take in a present day, although transitory, satisfaction. They remain obsessed with the fantasy of achieving complete release from the pain of their past and are stubbornly unaware that their desire is fantasy. It is this knowledge that such people are estranged from, for their fantasy must be owned as fantasy. The hungry ghosts must come in contact with the ghost-like nature of their own longings. Well, it takes no great leap of imagination to interpret this in contemporary terms as states of addiction. Alcohol and drugs, sexual addiction, addiction to pornography, addiction to the internet in general, overeating, addiction to shopping. And then there's this particular activity that can well be seen as being part of this hungry ghost realm, is that of gambling. Gambling is it's not so clear cut that's where it's the hungry ghost realm is the best place to put it, but I think it's just as good there as anywhere else. It could also be seen as part of the competitiveness of the Asura realm, the fighting titans. But there's this element of unceasing grasping for the big win that we see in gambling. And so we chose for this second in our film fest, the second movie on October 17th. We have a movie called Owning Mahoney, starring our own Philip Seymour Hoffman, Rochester's own, about a compulsive gambler. So any state of compulsiveness would be anything with the element of compulsion could be seen as part of this realm where we can't ever quite get enough. We're not free, but we're not free to act, but instead we're being acted upon. We're being driven. We're in the driver's seat. We're not driving. This is an awful state, of course. We have to point out, I should have done this earlier, that that those of us who are reflective enough and insightful enough can find within ourselves all six of these realms, or at least several of them. It's part of the adventure of Sesshin, is discovering that we can, in 1 week, we can partake of several or all six of these realms of unenlightened existence. And we know this. I've heard from many people who describe going through Sesshin and finding themselves gripped by this craving for a certain food or a certain other sensual experience. So it's a hungry ghost realm is describes a feeling of impoverishment, a feeling of a hunger for relief. Epstein says, this desperate longing for inexhaustible abundance is very common in the Western psyche, where it masquerades under the heading of low self-esteem. It is a mind state that has, paradoxically, proved difficult for many Eastern Buddhist teachers to understand in their Western students. The extent of inner feelings of emptiness and unworthiness in the Western psyche has seemed all but unbelievable to teachers raised in the East. I've in the past in Taisho I've described an exchange that I saw when I was at a conference of the Dalai Lama, where an American teacher of Tibetan Buddhism was describing his own tendencies to give way to this this inner critical voice, and the Dalai Lama's interpreter had the darndest time getting him to understand what this American teacher was talking about. It took 5 minutes of exchanges between the Dalai Lama and his interpreter before His Holiness seemed to kind of understand what this American teacher was talking about. But this is widely recognized by Asian teachers as a special American affliction, or maybe Western affliction, I don't know. This way of, sometimes it's called self-hatred. I think it's a little too strong. It's a feeling of unworthiness, self-judgments. And I know from my students and my own experience that this crops up all the time all too easily in states of meditation. Trungpa here, in his book, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, has a good description of this realm of hungry ghosts that, in the metaphorical sense, he says, in the hell realm, we're too busy struggling to even have time to consider the possibility of relief. But in this hungry ghost realm, we do find this hunger for more pleasurable, spacious conditions, and we fantasize numerous ways to satisfy this hunger. He says the torture of the hungry ghost realm is not so much the pain of not finding what we want, but rather it is the insatiable hunger itself which causes pain. This is because fundamentally we are fascinated with being hungry rather than with satisfying hunger. The quick frustration of our attempts to satisfy hunger enables us to be hungry again. So the pain and hunger of this realm, as with the aggression of the hell realm and the preoccupations of the other realms, provides us with something exciting to occupy ourselves with, something solid to relate to, something to make us feel secure that we exist as real people. We are afraid to give up this security and entertainment, afraid to venture out into the unknown world of open space. We would rather stay in this familiar prison, no matter how painful and oppressive it might be. In the traditional meal chants that are done in Buddhist temples and even in our own Zen center for the formal meals, we recite these chants of the hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits. All hungry ghosts, all thirsty spirits, now we give you this Dharma food. May it fill the 10 directions and satisfy hunger in realms of darkness. All hungry ghosts, all tortured spirits, abandon greed and rouse the desire for enlightenment. Now, in ancient times, there were descriptions of invisible hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits who are flitting about us as we're eating, craving this fulfillment that they can't have. Well, if you don't buy that, and my guess is that most people don't, or can't relate to it anyway, then here's how to understand the hungry ghosts and thirsty spirit offering that we make. We do it in our meals at the center, even the informal meals that we serve buffet style. There's a hungry ghost dish and a thirsty spirit dish at the end of the serving table. And we find some little tiny bit of dry food, which we place in the ghost dish, the hungry ghost dish, and just a tiny bit of our water that we serve at meals, a tiny bit of that that goes into the thirsty spirit dish. And this is best understood as a way, first of all, to acknowledge our own tendencies toward greed and longing and craving. This is vital. There is no one without these tendencies. So it's a little mindfulness practice to remind ourselves that we still are afflicted by these states of grasping, and at the same time, a way to satisfy them in a way. So when we place that little bit of a crust of bread into the hungry ghost dish, we're saying, okay, we still have these tendencies in us, and so here, be gone with you. Please accept this, and may we find peace from these compulsive longings. As always in Zen, we see it as more meaningful to have physical, concrete ways of expressing these things, not just say stopping and having a moment of reflection. That would be better than nothing. Most people would never consider, as they're eating, the many beings who are suffering hunger right now in this world, planet Earth. Never a thought of that. What we're doing is remembering them for just a moment, even if for one or two seconds. There's just this moment of reflection and acknowledgement of our own weaknesses in this area. And then through this little ritual, physically placing this food and then being able to move on into enjoying the meal after having had this remembrance. Here, the Bodhisattva shown in this realm, the hungry ghost realm, appears carrying a bowl filled with objects symbolic of spiritual nourishment. And the message here, of course, is that food and drink will not satisfy the unfulfilled needs of this realm. Only the non-judgmental awareness of practice offers such relief. Moving along here, we'll go on to the third lowest realm, which is that of animals. Here we don't need to talk about the literal understanding of animals. It means animals. So, figuratively speaking, this is a realm of a realm in which we're bound. We are bound to our drives. We're bound to our instincts. An animal realm, speaking literally, the realm of animals is one in which you have to eat or be eaten. And so it's a realm of fear. We often see the wonderful thing about animals. We can even romanticize animals as a purer state of being than our miserable human lives. But let's face it, it can be a realm of awful suffering. And some of this is shown in the movie that we found for this realm, which is about a donkey and the all the hardships and suffering of the life of a donkey. Epstein sees this realm, this animal realm, in psychological terms, as a realm of instinctual gratification of the biological drives of hunger and sexuality. So here you see, we can't always draw a bright line between one realm and the next. Here, this partakes also of the hungry ghost realm in terms of hunger. Trungpa describes this as a realm of stupidity in which we blind ourselves to what is around us and refuse to explore new territory, clinging to familiar goals and familiar irritations. Now this, I think, is very good. We are intoxicated with its safe, self-contained, familiar world, and so we fix our attention on familiar goals and pursue them with unswerving and stubborn determination. Thus, the animal realm is symbolized by the pig. A pig just eats whatever comes in front of its nose. It does not look right or left. It just goes right through. I recognize in this description the rigidity, the stubborn, rigid kind of person who just gets locked into their daily routines. This would be a kind of obsessive-compulsive experience, way of relating to the world. Just a life of dreary, the kind of dreary safety that comes from just a highly routinized, methodical way of experiencing our lives. Getting our stuff down, getting all of our habits in place, and then just sticking to them without wanting to experiment or explore. This too, this is a realm of fear. Why do we cling to the known and familiar, the habitual, the conditioned? Because of fear. What else there might be out beyond that? Mark Epstein keeps relating it to the sexual drive, which is fair enough. He points out that those who develop an interest in Buddhism have a tendency to try to escape from unresolved sexual issues through meditation. But this usually works only for a time. The more likely scenario is that the sexual issues become more pressing because of the spiritual work. This is a lesson that many spiritual groups of both East and West have had to learn over and over again. Ignoring the animal realm and its blind instincts only seems to empower it, as the sexual scandals that have rocked spiritual groups and leaders testify. And then he says, and this is, I think, very insightful, sexuality is a threat to spirituality only when it is not integrated. Now, integrated, surely he would agree, integrated doesn't have to mean playing out our sexual drives, acting them out. It's, again, awareness, noticing our sexual drives, noticing our cravings, and not trying to suppress them. This is the key thing. You don't have to play them out. It's one way to integrate them, one way to own them, but not the only way. As we know, for centuries, most of the great enlightened teachers of the world have maintained celibacy. Epstein further says, while the animal realm cannot be ignored, it can be put in its place. Sexuality certainly does not require the indulgence that is often associated with it, but it does not have to be separated from the enlightened mind. Here, in this animal realm, the bodhisattva is the bodhisattva image is shown where he or she is holding a book, which represents the capacity for thought, speech, and reflection that is lacking in our animal natures. Of course, this is what distinguishes the human realm from the animal realm, is this capacity to reason and think, to plan, to learn. Well, animals learn, but the higher brain functions, the discriminating mind that can understand consequences of just acting out our blind drives. The fourth lowest realm, right under the human realm, or we could of course say the third highest realm, is that of these fighting gods, the titans, the asuras. And these are shown traditionally in their literal sense as being very fearsome warrior types. Which is actually a good metaphor too, the warrior. Here, Trungpa says, we dream of ideal states that are superior to the pleasures and pains of the human realm, and we are always trying to achieve these states, always trying to be better than anyone else. It is a constant struggle to achieve perfection of some sort. Here we're obsessed with measuring our progress, comparing ourselves to others. It's a very competitive realm where we tend to relate to others in terms of either being above them or below them. Power. It's all about power. So there's a preoccupation here with always being best, with always being master of a situation. And this naturally makes us basically insecure and anxious, and always trying to control our territory, overcoming any threat to our achievements. This is a realm in which we're always fighting for mastery of the world. Here, of course, I think of anyone anyone in competitive pursuits, sports stars, of course, politicians, businessmen, academics, of course, these don't have to be this Asura realm, but boy, I've heard from so many people about the kind of brutal competitiveness in academia. But high achievers in general, anyone there recognize himself or herself? Here, the Bodhisattva, shown in this realm in the traditional Wheel of Life, shown holding a lute, like a guitar, signifying the musical pleasures. Oh, excuse me, wrong realm. Here it's Bodhisattva wielding a flaming sword, symbolic of discriminating awareness. You can see this actually as Manjushri. Manjushri and his sword, in a sense. It represents, reading from Epstein here, these beings, which embody the ego's aggressive strivings, are trying to garner the fruits of the gods through relentless competitive force. They represent the energy that is needed to overcome a frustration, change a situation, or make contact with a new experience. It is these fighting gods who embody the aggressive force necessary to approach, destroy, and assimilate the obstacles to satisfaction. Here we chose as the movie to represent this, Let There Be Blood with Daniel Day-Lewis. You know, for each of these realms, it could be at least several different movies that really capture the essence of the realm. And in the future, we can play, if anyone wants to continue with this experiment of a film festival, we can try other ones. And then there's the human realm, second only to the Deva realm. The human realm, I understand to be a realm of dilemmas. It's a realm of dichotomies, a realm where we're caught between two things. In traditional terms, we're caught between a desire and aversion, between this and that, between all kinds of dualities, higher and lower, better and worse, right and wrong. It is our higher minds, our discriminating intellects that creates these categories that only come to bind us. Epstein, with his psychological orientation, sees the human realm is where the tendency to hide from oneself is most pronounced. He says the human realm is concerned with what has come to be known as the self. More accurately, it is the realm of the search for self, the central concern of the relatively recent psychology of narcissism, and in some way, the abiding concern of all creative activity. He goes on, the central predicament of the human realm is that we do not really know who we are. We are aware of vague and disturbing feelings of emptiness, inauthenticity, and alienation, and we have some sense of the lack of acknowledgement, attention, or recognition that might lie behind these disturbing feelings. But we are fundamentally unsure the human realm, he says, is the linchpin of the wheel of suffering, the domain of Narcissus, in search of himself and captured by his own reflection. Of course, other dichotomies of the human realm are self and other, us and them, where we, many of us who come to practice, are struggling with finding the balance between fulfilling our own needs and attending to the needs of others, for example. He goes on, from the Buddhist perspective, the human realm is not just about the false self, but is also about the possibility of transcendent insight into the true nature of self. This is true. In Buddhist cosmology, it is understood that it is only through the human realm that we have the possibility of enlightenment. Epstein says it is here that the Buddhist concept of emptiness, shunyata, can be appreciated. The more we grasp emptiness, the more we feel real, that the core, the incommunicado element, is really a place of fear at our own insubstantiality. Trungpa, in describing the human realm, describes it as the realm of discriminating passion. Here we stop to consider what it is we are reaching for. We consider alternatives, we think more, and therefore we hope and fear more. This is, he says, the realm of passion and intellect. We explore, we feel textures, he says. We compare things. Actually, we could say it's the realm of picking and choosing, the realm of preferences, which is what we chant at the beginning of Affirming Faith in Mind. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. When preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. This, we could say, is the quintessential human problem, is being confronted by choices and our preferences between what we want and what we like, and on the other one hand, and on the other hand, what we don't want, what we don't like. Or we could say the choice between grasping and rejecting. In the human realm, we are always thinking about how to possess pleasurable things, how to get more. Gimme, gimme, gimme. But what we find is that although we can manipulate our world to achieve some pleasure, still we can't hold on to pleasure. We can't even always get what we want. And we're plagued by illness, old age, and death, by frustrations and problems of all kinds. Pain is just the flip side of pleasure. And that's another dichotomy that we're caught between, pain and pleasure. And finally, there is the highest unenlightened realm, that of the gods. We could say the Deva realm. This is traditionally shown as beings of light, of heavenly beings who can fly around and enjoy themselves in every kind of way. It's a sense of feeling that we've made it, that we've arrived. We have found what we've been looking for. And then we can begin to relax and to dwell upon our achievements, and shielding out undesirable things. So this, I always think of this realm as those of who are most admired in our society, the sports stars, the celebrities, the glamorous, beautiful people born into privilege and wealth, or who attain it somehow. Trungpa says it is a hypnotic like state. They do not have to bother with earthbound concerns. Think of wildly wealthy people, including celebrities. If they want to eat, they just direct their minds toward beautiful sights which feed them. It is the utopian world which human beings expect it to be. Everything happens easily, naturally, automatically. Epstein says that this is a realm, this God realm or Deva realm is a place of sensual bliss and gratification, of rapture and aesthetic pleasures. And in terms of the realm, in the realm of meditation, this would be the equivalent would be having peak experiences, states of very elevated, wonderful, blissful states. So here too, we through meditation, we can enter the God realm temporarily. And that's the whole point. They're all temporary. Every one of these six realms is temporary because they're the fundamental nature of reality has not been seen through awakening. In this realm, the bodhisattva is holding a lute, signifying the musical pleasures of that dimension, but also alerting those in this realm to the sounds of the Buddha's teachings. Here, the gods forget the sufferings of others. They are resting on their laurels and will one day fall from grace. Well, by the way, this realm of the gods, according to Buddhist cosmology, they have earned this relatively elevated state through good karma. It is so we see these stupendously wealthy people, the celebrities, the beautiful people, and we can see them as in the past having created a lot of good karma. But again, just as we can evolve through these six realms, we can also devolve, and we see this happening all the time. Well, our time is more than up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.